Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and we'll have a little bit of debt ceiling talk today, not wall-to-wall like we have the last few days. We'll take a little bit of a break from that. Our good martini today comes from the state of Ohio. Not only is there news out there that President Obama is not faring well right now against his potential Republican challengers in the 2012 midterm elections, and that his approval ratings are not good there. Of course, we have been big fans, and have been for a long time, of new Governor John Kasich, his efforts to rein in government spending as it relates to unions. And now the good people of Ohio have a chance to really have a clear voice and potentially lead the way into a major 2012 campaign issue, Jim. And that's whether or not Ohio is going to participate in the national health exchanges as part of Obamacare. It's pretty clear from every national survey that people do not want this. And getting that message from a bellwether state, which is what we hope happens, would be a great message going into 2012.
Kasich is one of those guys where whenever a Republican governor gets into trouble early in the term, I don't panic too early. What Kasich is trying to do in Ohio is very difficult. What Scott Walker was trying to do in Wisconsin is very difficult. What Rick Scott's trying to do in Florida, all these guys, there's a reason these things are you know, difficult to do. It's that, you know, people don't like seeing that their state governments make drastic reductions in spending, and they don't like seeing, you know, whenever they see public sector unions complaining, even if they're not, you know, the public isn't wholeheartedly, you know, backing the public sector unions, there's kind of this sense of, I just don't want this issue. I want this issue to go away. I don't like seeing this kind of conflict. So every GOP governor who's trying to attempt serious reform is taking on a difficult task. And this referendum that they're going to have in this November in Ohio looked like it was going to be, you know, potentially trouble. At this point, you know, at least when it was announced, the unions and the public sector unions were way more enthusiastic about it and fired up about it and you know, frothing at the mouth about it than conservatives in Ohio were. And now, at the very least, there's something to really get the conservatives to come out. And in fact, I remember hearing at least one of the RNC chair candidates last cycle saying, if Republicans are smart, they will put referendums on Obamacare on the ballot in November 2011 and November 2012, whenever possible. Because when this happened in Missouri on Republican primary day, it passed 77% to like 22% or something. Some off-the-charts landslide. It was a great driver for Republican turnout. So this is an issue that really, you know, gets people in their bones, gets people to mobilize, gets people active and bringing their friends to the polls. And so the idea of having this on the ballot in Ohio is a great idea. The only thing is you almost kind of wish it could be 2012 instead of 2011, but Kasich may need the help sooner.
And it could be momentum for other states to put it on there in 2012 and have that on the ballot at the same time the president is. And if it's a big win for the anti-Obamacare movement, that will be a feather in a cap for the Republican nominee, unless, of course, it's someone who kind of supported similar things in his state when he was governor. Anyway, on to number two now, and back to the debt ceiling very briefly. And Jim, you know, the president, of course, we talked about it at length yesterday, went on television Monday night extolling the virtues of increasing taxes on corporate jet owners, oil companies, hedge fund managers, and so forth. At the White House briefing on Tuesday, much to the credit of the Washington Press Corps, which doesn't necessarily deserve a lot of credit a lot of the time, they went after Jay Carney for the fact that the president didn't offer anything specific. And here's the latest incarnation of why the president doesn't actually have a plan.
Purpose of putting forward a plan on paper, our interest in this has been to get a compromise, to get a deal. It has not been to politically position ourselves, say, with things that appeal to our base, maybe pieces of legislation that we know can't pass, but it'll be, you know, greeted warmly by certain constituencies. Our goal, and the reason why the negotiations have been conducted the way they have been conducted, is because we want a result.
Jim, first of all, there's been an unlimited amount of pandering from the White House, so the idea that they're not going after certain demographics is ridiculous, although it's probably more the middle than the base. And I find the strategy fascinating that to get results, you don't actually have specific ideas. That seems to be a new way of thinking in Washington.
Look, it's very complicated, Greg. I wouldn't expect you to understand. But basically, the way to get a compromise is to not propose a compromise. The way to get the very best deal on paper is to refuse to put a deal on paper. It's an entire kind of Zen, go left to go right, go backwards to go forwards. Only the really smart people can understand it, like the president and Jay Carney. Yeah, you think about this and you think it's an earlier statement of, we've shown a lot of leg, which was his characterization of their sense of their debt ceiling budget deal position. I just thought of that and was thinking of if the CBO had a hard time scoring speeches, I can only imagine how they can score a lot of leg. But looking at all of this and kind of concluding that, you know, Jay Carney, when he stepped into this job, I mean, Gibbs was, you know, obnoxious and snide and dismissive. And I think it was one of the Washington Post columnists who said he acts like he's playing himself in the movie. He's convinced that he's the sharp, quick-witted one and, you know, not instead of alienating everybody else in the entire White House press corps. Carney comes in, and Carney was just a reporter just like 3-4 years ago. This is not a guy who spent his whole year in campaign work and political spin. And there were such high hopes that Carney would be better, that Carney would be a little more direct, a little more open. If he didn't know the answer, he'd just come out and say he didn't know the answer. There'd be less spin, less, you know, attempting to defend the indefensible. Well, now Carney believes it's absolutely, completely unreasonable to expect the President of the United States to put a budget deal down on paper. Now, I wrote in the Morning Jolt this morning, don't you want to write it down just in case you forget? I mean, how many good ideas have you lost? I hope they at least transcribed it, speak it into a post-it note, even that, you know.
So. Yeah, some notes taken during one of these endless meetings, something. You know,
a finger, a string around the finger or something, just something, you know, because otherwise the details get fuzzy. This, of course, presumes the president's plan has details. What we all kind of deeply suspect is there is no plan. That's why it's not on paper. It's all this kind of amorphous set of principles of being for all good things and opposed to all bad things. And unsurprisingly, the math does not work out on that. So Carney has, you know, bit by bit morphed into Gibbs. There is no improvement. He's the exact same guy. And I think that's all we're going to get out of this White House.
Yeah, the only possible defense for Carney is that, you know, he has these meetings with the president, communications director before the briefing, and he actually is trying to explain to them why this won't fly. And they don't, just do that and try that. And you just picture Carney back at his desk going, all right, I'll do what I can.
Doing it for a memoir. Big consulting gig after this. I can do this. I can hold out for 2 more years.
Well, on to number 3 now, and unfortunately, this is not a funny one. This is an outrage that's been an outrage ever since the day that we knew it was going to happen, and that's the release of the Lockerbie bomber, Almeg Rahi, the only person ever convicted for it, served a few years in Scotland, and then, of course, back in August of 2009, got released due to basically medical compassion reasons, because he was supposed to die of prostate cancer within 3 months. The United States, at least most of the people in the U.S., were outraged at this. The Obama administration says they argued against it. How vociferously or if at all remains a good question. Now it appears that not only is Almeg Rahi still alive, he's alive and well because he was at a Muammar Gaddafi rally recently in Libya and was chronicled as being there and being a fairly enthusiastic participant. So apparently the About to Die Act has clearly worn off, and the UK, the US, got completely rooked by this, and unfortunately for a lot of families out there affected by the Lockerbie bombing, they're watching a complete injustice being slapped in their face.
You know, Greg, the Lockerbie bomber has the most flexible drop-dead date since the US debt ceiling. I mean, every time you turn around, you go, it's supposed to be this date. I think a lot of Americans look at this and say, really? We can't help him along some? I know Kevorkian passed away a little while ago. Can't we find somebody to kind of help him along, say, we don't want you to suffer in your final days? We're not surprised by this. It's frustrating. I do remember somebody at one point saying, just kind of on a whim, when this was noted earlier that he was, you know, not keeling over on schedule, just kind of looking at what the airfare was from Dulles to Tripoli. This was back when, you know, it was a little safer to travel to Libya, and it was really kind of quite reasonable. So if you could find the guy, it wouldn't be that hard to, you know, send somebody over there to just kind of, you know, put that pillow at night and make it in. I tweeted this somewhat in jest. Clearly, I'm not really, you know, of losing much sleep over the health of the Lockerbie bomber. And somebody said, well, I guess that makes you just like him, doesn't it? You know, that blowing up a plane makes you every, you know, if you'd want to kill a guy who blows up a plane, you're every bit as bad as the guy who blows up a plane. I fail to see I guess I just don't have a nuanced enough conscience to draw the equivalency there. So anyway, we continue the Lockerbie bomber death watch with great frustration. This just handed to me. He's still alive, but we can keep hope alive, Greg.
Yeah, apparently so. Yeah, I love the equivocation there that your wish to perhaps have him rubbed out is the equivalent of blowing up Lockerbie. I'm shocked that one of these kinetic military action sorties can't be slightly rerouted. I don't know.
That's a good way. There's got to be some valuable target in his neighborhood. And, you know, we can, making air quotes, miss and just happen to hit his house. And, or at least his, you know, kidney dialysis machine or something like that. Something that would, you know.
As you pointed out earlier, Jim, we're trying to accidentally kill Gaddafi. I don't know how much of an addition this would be to the mission. So, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
We've gone from morbid to Andy Rooney to now the special knocking somebody off edition of the Three Martini Lunch.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.